On your schedule today, one thing that is not listed, and I'm sure all of you will be very happy to know, we do have a representative from Finial Technology today, Rob Reese, and he will be speaking last in the order here. John Allen so far has not shown up, so I can't promise you anything in that regard, but we do have a very good panel. I think you'll be very pleased with it. First up, we're going to have a colleague of mine, Ken Whistler, who you've already heard from this morning. Ken's one of his responsibilities was to work on developing a laser playback system for cylinder recordings, with all of the implications involved. Ken has been with us now for about almost four years. We call him our senior sound engineer. He's quite a capable person, and I'll let Ken take you off on that now.
We're going to do some background information first on the cylinders, and then talk about the laser cylinder player, and then I'll play a tape for you that has some examples of various methods of playback for cylinders. So first, I guess we'll turn on, if you could turn on the lights for the projector, or turn on the slide projector there, so we can get the lights on. So, yeah, it's the top switch there, just slide it all the way forward.
Turn the light on
until
you can find the switch.
There you go. Thank you. Just to do some background on the cylinders themselves, this is a chart that came out of maybe an Arts newsletter almost. Just the different kind of waxes that we're looking at here in the wax cylinders. I hope everybody's familiar with the cylinder format. There are some very special problems and unique problems that it has, which we've been trying to address. They're saying it's really not wax. They're saying, well, it could be made out of beeswax, carnauba wax. I can't even say this word, spermaceti, serine, montan wax. It's an organic material, and it has special problems because you can't treat it like plastic. You have to realize that this thing is attacked by fungi. This thing will not stand being hot and then cold. This thing will not stand being picked up in your hands. And of course, this was 60 or 70 years ago when people did all those things. So what we're dealing with now is the results of that kind of handling. This is another chart. I think this was taken out of a Tom Owens paper. What the various chronology of the wax development, the white wax, the concert size brown wax, new process brown, gold molded wax, and then they finally got to the blue ambrol, which is a plastic, a celluloid type of plastic. The problem is, what was nice about the cylinder is it was a constant pitch because it traveled across at a constant speed. It was a constant speed rotation so that the sound reproduction was consistent from the beginning to the end of the record. But it has some problems where you have to overcome the shrinkage of the cylinder. You have to overcome the attack of the cylinder by various molds and so on. Let's take a look at some of the cylinder problems. This is a picture of the cylinder reproducer that we have at the archive. This is a model of, or rather it's a replica of one of the original cylinder player, and this is one of the 13 that was commissioned by Edison. And basically, you know, you just have an embossing device, that's the, I think the recording end there, and there's some tin foil, it just embosses into the groove. And you have a feed screw mechanism that takes it across. And so there's your constant pitch, and there's your constant speed here, this handle. I just wanted to contrast that with what you get now. This is a more modern tone arm, of course, and it has to have anti-skate because of the centrifugal forces effects. You have to have some kind of a balancing device, there's a weight, counterweight, and so on. And it's really a completely different technology that I'm not even addressing with this cylinders. Let's just take a look at some of the cylinders. Here's a beautiful white wax cylinder. And you don't see many of these in that kind of condition. You see more of them like this. There's a nice black, another black wax, and a very very rough looking black wax. And this, the collection goes like that. You know, you could just get the same batch you might have, good and bad. And I try to get examples. Here's some more early brown ones, good and bad. It just, you try to figure out some way to address both these problems. And here's a very rough black one. What happened here, I'm really not sure, but it may have been some kind of glue was used on that crack. Pardon me?
That's what it looks like.
Yeah, and was just the right food for whatever's eating it there. And of course you can't take this stuff off because it's the surface. If you take it off, the sound is not underneath. The sound came off with it, so there you are. We're moving up in time here. The later black, you see there's the embossed edge and so on. It gets harder, but it still dries out. It's still brittle. I don't know if anybody's ever had that experience. You pick one of these up and you think, what a beautiful thing, and then crack right in your hand. And you know, what can you do? It's just an awful feeling. And we're getting on to, they solve most of these problems by going with the cellulose, the blue amberols. But this, even that, this is an Edison here, and of course they had a plaster core. And the trouble with the plaster core is it absorbs water, and this, you can see, is split right down the middle. So what we wanted was some way to not touch these cylinders, because they're already pretty well beat up. I'm showing you, this is the acoustic reproducer that we used in the early laser transport. This is out of, I think, an Edison concert machine. And you see the weight plate there, and it might weigh, I think, 4 ounces or so, 4 or 5 ounces. And you think, well, gee, well, that's not too bad. And then you realize there's about 28 grams to the ounce. And today's cylinders track at 0.5 gram, you know, and this thing might weigh 150 or so grams. So that's pretty heavy when you try to play something that you don't want to hurt the surface of. What it ends up is the more you weigh, you might as well just be shaving the surface off here. This is what I'm doing here. This is a brass cylinder, just to drive the point home. But it's all lathe technology, really. It's essentially what it is. You cut it in with something, and then you read it back with something else in a constant constant rotation, constant translation. So, some things that have been tried for playing back things. This is a Schifrin transport. These things cost about $8,000, as I understand it. And that's a Rabco arm, and not too many of these things were produced and not too many sold. But it's the idea is, of course, we're getting better and better tracking, and we're handling the cylinder better. And another thing that's tried, can you see this sketch here? This is just some notes that we made when I was starting the work on the laser playback. For a while there, we were also trying to see if there was a device, an acoustic interferometer, which is essentially a vibrating piezoelectric wand that somehow had to have a bubble for contact. This is the catch. It had to be fluid bubble there on the tip of that. And you could read, just like a radar or sonar, you could shoot down, it's the 1 megahertz sound waves down this piezoelectric crystal, and you read the reflection. And the difference between what you send out and what you get back, that was the audio. But the problem was, how do you keep this bubble alive while you're spinning and moving and so on? So we investigated it, but it just sort of didn't go too far. One of the things we did in order to get an idea of what we were after, this is the early laser transport, but I put an arm on it. And even though the arm is a regular transcription turntable arm, 16-inch size, it doesn't turn sideways like a regular tone arm does. I just mounted it hard on this one spot, and of course the cylinder translates across the front of it. You can see I even adapted a cartridge holder so that it went straight out instead of at an angle like the tone arms are. So this cylinder transport, this early model, we were able to put on a tone arm like that. We also were able to fit the acoustic reproducer to it. Just to see, you know, we wanted to see, what is this thing going to sound like? What should it sound like? What did it used to sound like? What are we going to get out of it with our various methods? Let's see. Yeah. Some of the testing we did on the acoustic playback, I mean, this is all background to the laser playback system, because we really wanted to find out what were we dealing with at the present before we started to jump off into various ways to play it back. Would we be actually improving the situation or making it worse? So we wanted to make sure we understood the nature of the problem that we were dealing with. We were able to use Brule and Kerr instrumentation to determine the actual playback characteristic of the acoustic system. What you see here is a shaker. A shaker is actually like a small speaker. It's a speaker without the cone, actually, and it's calibrated and so on. And we feed in pseudo-random noise of a known level and a known bandwidth. And we actually excite, you can see here there's an accelerometer on the top of the shaker, and then we excite vertically the reproducing system. The idea is if you you know the signal going in, because you're using an accelerometer with a transducer attached, so you know the input signal. And you take the calibrated microphone, you put it on the horn, so you know the input, you know the output over the input, loosely speaking, gives you the transfer function. And that gives us an idea of the characteristic of the playback system. Yeah, and what this is a printout, it's sort of a compilation of three different playback systems using that arrangement. The top is the wooden S-shaped horn, the signet horn, the swan-shaped horn, with a two-minute reproducer, which is the one of the earlier, I think it was a Type C, or I think it was a Type C reproducer. And you see here on the, maybe you can't see on the curve actually, but this line here, this line is about 3K. So you have a sort of a straight, a flat output, and then it just really drops off rapidly around 3K. These tick marks are every two. So there's four, there's six, and so on. It just drops right off. Contrast that with the same horn, but with the four-minute reproducer. Is it? Is that focus all right? No. Somewhere in there. Oh. Anyway, back there you go. The four-minute reproducer, this is actually a special reproducer. It was a sort of a phenolic diaphragm that had rings cut into it. It was a special, I think this is a special, a custom rebuilding, rebuilt diaphragm rather than an original issue. But all that work did for us was just give us this lump right around 3K, and then it's still the same sharp drop-off. And then down at the bottom is the diamond disc horn. That's that. That's the same horn, except it was inverted, mounted underneath, and the outer lip was taken off so that it would fit inside the Edison cabinet. This is what they used on the Edison diamond disc players. We just thought we'd throw this in for comparison and see how their technology was increasing. And you see it does have a more smooth cutoff, but it does have these anti-resonances that occur very periodically all the way down. And it drops off again around 4K on this. So this gives us an idea. So what we're looking at, the best we can hope for to get out of this system might only be about 4K or so. Or if we get anything higher than that, we have to really look hard to get it. Maybe this would be a good time to play back this tape here, just to illustrate. We'll turn the lights on again, and then I have some more slides after that. Oh. I'll explain what that is. After that cut there, yeah, right there. Thank you. That was the, Every Ship Will Find a Harbor. That was recorded in 1908, and that was played back. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? That's the acoustic playback system. Sounds really nice. Let's hear what that sounds like with the laser playback, an early model of the laser playback. And this was originally done in 1984, this particular song. Of course, what do we hear? Tons of surface noise, but we're not touching that cylinder. and they yes, there's sort of a rumble through there. But we're not discouraged because, of course, you know, if you've got a constant amplitude, constant bandwidth kind of noise, our friend white noise, you can actually take most of that out. And this next little piece is down about 10 dB, so maybe we can boost the sound here. But what we did was we took this up to an Air Force base near where we are in Rome, New York. They have a noise reducing system that they use in the cockpit. And it wasn't really meant for music, but we just thought we just, if we could, get a demonstration of what might be available to us. We could just play that. Of course, that sounds pretty good. The hum came from the audio hookup that we had there. We really weren't allowed to do anything. We're on the Air Force base, and the guy says, try this out. And so we did. You know, we took what we could get. But it has promise. You can tell that the constant noise problem can be solved. It's just something that you have to address, which is what we're addressing where we are now. We just acquired a VAX 8300, which is a, you know, big little computer. It has plenty of storage, about a gigabyte. That ought to do it, don't you think? And actually, we got two computers and an Ethernet to connect them with, and we have a sound digitizer to put it in with and ILS software to look at it with. So we're really going to go after this noise reduction problem. That's the next big thrust of the work of the archive. Let's just continue with this tape here. Just to round it out here, I'll play back. This piece is using that tone arm. The straight tone arm on that same cylinder with a custom stylus. Here. This next piece is done with a little fiber optic displacement probe. And just to see, because what this originally is for is to measure displacement of vibrating surfaces without touching them. It's an optical lever, what's called an optical lever. In fact, you can even play this thing back where, you know, the more we play with it, the more you can pick it up with a straight fiber optic, straight fiber with a reflected light. It's not great reproduction, but you find there are several variables that you can adjust to get a sound off a cylinder. But you see that? Now that's the tracking when you get two sounds like that. And this last piece, just so you remember, this is what it sounded like acoustically. And you'll be humming that for days, I'm sure. This is Byron G. Harlan. Mm-hmm. I just have a few more slides of the laser transport that we're using now. You saw earlier versions of that. You saw an earlier version that was on an aluminum transport. This is what we're up to now. This is like the third rebuild. This is just the transport end of things. You see, here's the mandrel with a constant speed motor, or adjustable speed motor that runs constantly. I guess.
You know what I mean? Turn it off.
I mean, it's adjustable, but once you set it, it's locked. That's what I mean. And it has tachometer pulse output. from the back of the shaft that runs that stepper motor in the back there. And the stepper motor is what takes it across the translation motor. So if I slow this motor down, the translation motor slows down proportionally. So I have, in effect here, an electronic Edison concert player. And by separating the two masses, you have lots more control over the tracking by just doing that. And this is a special pitch screw and so on. And let's see, you can just see one of the lens heads here. And there's the optical pickup there. This is just the laser end of things. It also is mounted on an optical bench rail. What we're finding is the more rigid we make the mounting system, the more money we spend on this optical system, the better it sounds. Because what it translates into is a more precise pointing system. And that's what you need on something like this. This is the spatial filter, which allows us to get most of the optical noise out of the laser beam as it comes out sort of raw out of the laser. And why did I take this shot? I'm not sure. It's the same shot we had before. Okay, that's it for the laser transport, and I guess we'll just entertain a few questions for a minute or something.
We've got time for maybe a couple of questions.
Yes.
Well, I'd like to ask this of others as well, but what are they going to start putting the overtones back into the record?
Well, how do you mean?
Well, the one that can start figuring out what the overtones are were in the original recording because of the frequency limitations, and then put them back in.
Oh, I see. Sort of like the way the brain hears sound is it will supply overtones even if they're not there, like undertones. You can hear bass lower than actually is being sent and so on. All I can guess is that what we're doing now with the software that allows us to look at the present sound information, we should be able to try to reproduce, or actually it's recreating the sound. What we want to do is try to compare even pattern matching. If we had someone put in a sample to our computer of a piano, for instance, we could have the computer listen for a piano and try to supply just the piano sounds and maybe even supply extra sound, recreate the piano sounds in the sound envelope.
Has anybody actually done this yet?
No, that's something that it's certainly possible to try because they do that with speech technology when they're analyzing speech.
Are you attempting to recreate the sound that was originally being like the original performance or the sound on an original player?
Yeah. this is a good question. See, well, there's of course there's two lines of thought on this, you see, because what you see by the playback or the reproducing curves from that white noise or the pseudorandom noise sample is that there's not much in there. The information that we're going to get off is going to be limited by the playback system. So, you know, what we're expecting to find may not have been available to anyone. But at the same time, if we can undo that transfer function, undo the transfer function of the wax to stylus interface, and undo the transfer function of the recording mechanism, if we can undo those three transfer functions, we should be able to look down the singer's throat and get the sound back out, because, I mean, in theory, that's all you have to do is just flip these mathematical models over. Way in back there?
Are you experimenting with the new laser photograph record player at all?
Geez, if we had one, we would. You know? But that's another issue. We've heard about it, and we're very interested in it.
I might have an application here, because it's
similar. Yeah, and it's a simpler problem, but it's still very complex.
Okay, one more. Joe?
I was commenting on the quality that you were saying. Mm-hmm. Point of information, the BBC Grand Library has tried laser beam replaying. And of course they're running up against the problem that the laser beam is unselective. It not only picks up the signal, the damage in the groove,
yeah.
And they abandoned the project because of that deficiency.
Well, we're hoping that, you know, not by making it a batch process, not a real-time process, we can run it through several sets of filters, several sets of analyzing techniques, and clean it up without destroying the actual sonic content, but just getting rid of all the extra stuff.
Can you modulate to a laser beam? Because that's what you need to do.
Well, you mean with a chopper or something? This one doesn't modulate, but I think I understand what you're saying. This one doesn't.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Ken. Appreciate it.